This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An indie filmmaker and ISU graduate is about to scare the pants off moviegoers.
One of like the biggest elements that I wanted to bring to this movie is kind of letting the audience create the fear for themselves.
Zach Fairley talks with Laura Kennedy about his new premiere and his first short film, Beyond Normal. Plus, the end of a storied broadcasting career, the tough job of a hospice chaplain, and hip pocket rides again. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. After a broadcast career spanning more than 40 years in Bloomington Normal, one of GLT's most familiar and beloved voices, we'll call it quits today. Willis Kern is retiring after 24 years at GLT and Illinois State University. GLT General Manager R.C. McBride talked with Willis about his time in local radio. Kern says he's a townie and a rare person whose career path turned out more or less as he envisioned.
Yeah, and I always really had in the back of my mind that I would work in radio in this community my whole life. And that's what's happened. It's just kind of worked out that way. When I was a kid, I aspired to be on the radio. You know, yeah, I would listen to Harry Carey during Cardinal games, and I wished that one day I could be the Cardinals announcer. But, you know, as you get older, you start to be realistic about career goals. And yeah, I guess I'm about right where I envisioned myself when I was 10 or 12 years old, doing a career of radio here in Bloomington Normal.
So walk us through. Tell us how your career actually began, your professional career.
Well, my professional career began shortly after I graduated from high school because I went to a technical broadcasting school in Minneapolis at the recommendation of my father, who I think was probably really interested in not forking over a four-year college education. And I think having kids now, I see where he was coming from. But I went to a technical school in Minnesota and got out in less than a year, came back home, and fairly quickly got a job at a station in Normal that's now defunct. It used to be where the sign for Advocate Broman Health is at the corner of Main and Virginia. It's a country and western station. But the way the station was set up, it was a directional signal with six antennas, an antenna array of six antennas, and you had to have a first-class license in order to operate there. And I happened to have a first-class license. It was part of the studying that I had done. And so I was hired only as an engineer overnights, and I spent my time building tape cartridges in the middle of the night between midnight and 6 a.m., the old-fashioned cartridges that used to play commercials and songs on. I built those part-time working overnight because I had an engineer's degree, and they had a bluegrass announcer who had no radio experience at all. So I was the techie, and he was the on-air talent, and he let me do a newscast in the middle of the night, about 3:30 in the morning. And one time, the news director, who at that time was a guy by the name of Larry Deitch, who went on to a career as Larry Morgan, doing a play-by-play for University of Iowa and Drake University, among others, he heard me, and he went an afternoon slot, came open in news later that summer. He offered it to me, and I took it. So I was doing news broadcasts, local news on the air, and I was less than a year out of high school. I really didn't know what I was doing. I was kind of faking my way through it. And so I went to college and got a degree at ISU. That the station eventually changed formats. I moved on to WJBC, where I worked part-time, and then after I graduated from college, got a full-time job as a nighttime announcer. Worked there for about 15 years, and then this opening came up here at GLT as assistant news director in the early 90s, and I was at a point in my life where I needed better hours, had a family, young kids, so it made sense to make that move. I did, became news director 4 years later, and here we are 20 years after that.
about ready to retire. We're speaking with news director for One More Day, soon to be news director emeritus, Willis Kern, here on GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm R.C. McBride. So I'm listening to you tell all these stories. And, you know, in those days, it was pre-automation. You had to have a qualified engineer on hand 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was a much more highly technical vocation than what it is now.
That's true. And I studied to get my first class FCC license, but I really didn't know the ins and outs. Again, I was just out of high school, and I really wasn't interested in the engineering side of it. I just knew enough to be able to pass and get this license.
So what attracted you to the idea of journalism?
Well, I loved listening to newscasters on the radio. I listen to radio all the time. I consider myself more of a broadcaster than a journalist. But part of that, of course, is journalism, and especially back in the days in the 60s and when I was listening to the radio in my younger years, news on the radio was an hourly thing, and sometimes it was a half hour long, and, you know, I would listen to that, and I really became interested in it. And then when I was in high school, I took up radio speaking in speech my senior year. I had never done any speech work at all. And I finished third in the state, and I realized, you know, I might have a future in this. And so I guess I always had a desire. Of course, this was in the early 70s, so you're talking Watergate, when journalism was really beginning to catch on among interests of young people. And I think I was involved in that. I wouldn't go so far as to say that I'm a journalist today because of Watergate, but I think that had a lot to do with it.
So what maybe our younger listeners might not understand, and when I say younger, I mean really maybe anybody under 35 at this point.
I was going to say 40, yeah.
But in those days, radio was the immediacy. If you watched local news in those days, there were more stations doing local news, but you had to wait till 6 or 10 o'clock to watch that. And you had to wait for the morning, or actually even here with the Pantograph at one time, the afternoon newspaper. So if you wanted anything, if anything happened now and you needed to get that information out in a hurry, radio was your only, and local radio was your only option.
Oh, yes. In fact, I remember I was working at JBC in the early 80s when the Pantograph shifted from a primarily afternoon newspaper to a morning newspaper. And I remember the news director there, Steve Ogle, and Don Munson, the program director, came up with this catchy slogan to promote the news as "Today's News Today." It really hacked off the people of the Pantograph because it was aimed right at them. But it was a good slogan. I mean, and it highlighted just what you're talking about, the immediacy of radio and getting the news on when it's news, when it's happening now.
You come to GLT then in 1993. So you make the transition here, which I imagine was different. I mean, community-oriented, but different.
Yes. Not quite to the point that it is today, and definitely not to what JBC was back in those days. It really hurt my parents. My parents thought I had just, I mean, what are you doing? You know, you're the talk of the town every night, and what are you doing? And it took some time, but it, you know, it was better for me personally. Professionally, it was definitely better. I think it worked out well for both stations. JBC was able to do some things in the evening that they weren't able to do with me as the host, and I was able to help shift GLT into a certain direction here. So I think it worked out really well. You know, when I look back on my career, 40-some years now, I think about how fortunate I have been able to be really involved in really the golden era, I think, at two different radio stations. I really think that JBC, and I know you may differ about this a little bit, but I think that late 70s, early 80s era at JBC was really terrific. I mean, we did a lot of great things. There were a lot of very talented people working there for long stretches, which is fairly unusual in radio. Usually, you know, turnover is pretty rapid, but it wasn't the case there. And there were a lot of, I mean, the ratings were fantastic. The morning show was off the roof. The Chicago Tribune came down and did a feature article about the station. It was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune because it was such an unusual thing to have a popular radio station located in the middle of a cornfield like that. And then here at this radio station at GLT, I think this has been the golden era for this station over the last 20 years, really. What we've been able to do with gaining a real foothold in the community and becoming more and more involved in community events. And again, a lot of great, talented people who've been here for a long time, and that's really unusual.
I'm R.C. McBride, interviewing Willis Kern on GLT's Sound Ideas. It is unusual to have people last so long. I mean, when I came into this station, you have Charlie and you and Jim and Mike and Bruce, and it goes on, Laura. John Norton is the new guy, and I think he was hired in 2001. Very unusual. You mentioned that JBC had that tendency when you were there, and really when I was there, until still to this day. To me, that says something about the community. That says something about Bloomington Normal in McLean County.
It's a great place to live. And when I met my wife Stacy, who worked at the station when she came to town, that's how she came into Bloomington. She got a job at the same radio station I was working at, worked together for about 3 or 4 years before she went on and decided somebody in the family needed to make a living, so which has worked out well. But when she came to town, she was born and raised in the Chicago suburbs, and she told me, she says, you know, we're not going to be here very long. And I said, oh, yeah? She says, no, this is a small town. You know, we'll be here for a while. And then, well, it turned out that she became attached to the community, loved it. We decided to raise our family here. It's a terrific place to raise a family. My kids are both gone, but I know that they value their upbringing here, and it really provided the foundation for them to be successful where they are now. So, yeah, this is a terrific community, and I think that has a lot to do with why you see radio people come here, succeed, and stay, and not necessarily move on.
Do you have any individual specific memories that stand out about your time at GLT?
I think, the one that stands out probably more than any other, and I think this is true if you ask any veteran journalist this who was working during 9/11, it was what happened at 9/11 and the way that the world changed, our industry changed at that time, the way the radio station, the way NPR covered things changed after that. But that definitely was a very memorable time, not necessarily obviously for good reasons, But there were a lot of good things that came out of that. You have to have something good come out of something bad. And I remember covering a Unitarian church service that night. And that was a weird day because I was out jogging in the morning and got a phone call about the second plane hitting. And I had my jogging clothes on all day until I went to cover this event in the evening. I had gone home and showered, but I worked the whole day in my jogging clothes. So, yeah, that's obviously one real memory that I have.
Well, and we actually have the piece that you mentioned, so we're going to listen to just a bit of that right now.
I'm Willis Kern. At the Unitarian Church, Minister David Robbins recounted the day's horrifying events, saying that although the attacks occurred on the East Coast, all Americans feel anger, grief, and vulnerability. He then led a prayer for victims and their families, as well as the nation's leaders.
We are a part of a web of life that makes us one. We are grateful for the miracle of consciousness that we share, the consciousness that gives us the power to remember, to love, to reach out, to care.
The church's director of religious education, Linnell Greenberg, read from a children's book about peace.
Peace is not a gap between times of fighting or a space where nothing happens. Peace is something that lives, grows, spreads within us all and needs to be looked after.
And as we listen to that, It reminds me of the work that your news team is still doing now. I believe that people still have a hunger for what's going on in their communities. And that is what makes GLT so special. And I hope will continue to make GLT special is whether that is a local view out into the world or just the things that are happening here. I just think community is vitally important.
Oh, it is so now for radio, is probably more so now than ever, because of the nature of available information, the internet. And, you know, you can listen to all kinds of podcasts and get any kind of viewpoint about anything. But if you want to know about your community, where you live, and what's going on around you, radio, I think, still is the most efficient and probably professional way of getting that information.
Well, I'd like to leave it with some parting shots or parting thoughts by you, Willis. Anything you would like to tell the audience at large before you hang it up as a full-time broadcaster?
I would. I'm very concerned about the industry of journalism, particularly radio journalism. I think it's under siege, not only in this country, but in this world. So I'm very concerned about how it's going to come out. When I was a young student, I was challenged about the future of our industry, the radio industry, and told that, you know, the Great Recession of 1974 is going to kill the radio industry, and that didn't happen. So I'm a little leery about doomsday scenarios like that, but I really think that the whole industry of journalism is under siege, and I just kind of hope and pray that things work out and common sense prevails.
Willis, we're very sad to see you go, but we're also happy that you're going to have an opportunity to do some great things in retirement. Do you have any specific plans?
Not really. I got a few things in the back of my head that I'm not really gotten to the point where I'm ready to talk about them. Some may pan out, some may not. But I'm extremely, extremely blessed to have worked with so many great people through the years. The relationships you build with listeners and people who encounter you on the other side of the radio, that means the world to me, and it will continue to be what I base a lot of my values and ideals on, those relationships. So it's an honor to have worked in this industry for as long as I have, and I appreciate the good thoughts and appreciate the opportunity to do what I do.
Thank you for all that you've contributed to our community, and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, RC.
I'm RC McBride. That, of course, is Willis Kern, who is calling it a retirement at the close of business today. I'd like to leave this with the sound of Willis doing a story that was picked up by NPR.
This is NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Willis Kern of member station WGLT report.
Closing arguments are scheduled for today, with the case reaching the jury by this afternoon. For NPR News, I'm Willis Kern.
Speaking personally, Willis Kern has been a fantastic boss, mentor, colleague, and example, and a great gift to the community. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC, offering 26 years of experienced, reputable, and timely financial management with a contemporary, independent perspective. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hollywood is 2,000 miles from normal, but one local indie filmmaker is proving cinematic creativity can flourish anywhere. Laura Kennedy has more.
Zach Fairley has always had a passion for movies and filmmaking. Though he just graduated from Illinois State University a year ago, he already has two short films to his credit, including his latest, Black Book, which has its premiere tomorrow at the Normal Theater, with another showing May 3rd. Fairley started young, acquiring his first video camera at the age of 15. Now he has his own studio, Vigilant, where he produced his first work, the comedy Beyond Normal.
It was straight out of the mind of a college guy. We used a lot of like our own humor, which sometimes is a little raunchy. Translated a lot of that into the story. One of my favorite shows is Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that I wanted to shoot that film was very much so similar to the look that they do for that show. You know, wide angle, kind of shaky camera movements, kind of having very outrageous characters.
Well, look who it is, Brian.
Hey, guys.
What's up?
Why the long face, man?
I had a rough night.
Didn't you have that date last night?
The f***? I haven't even seen you near a girl, and you had a date last night?
Yeah.
How come you didn't tell me?
So what happened?
Well, she was a really nice girl.
All right, wait, what are we talking nice here? Wisconsin scale? Because I banged a 9.5 last night.
I'm not taking beer or cheese into account. She was a really nice girl.
So you banged?
No, but I could have if I wanted to.
Where'd you meet her again?
Well, she's the bartender over at Harvey's Tap. But I officially met her on this new dating app called Pinder.
But listen, man, if you're not going to f*** her, then I'm going to have to.
No, you can't.
Now, your second film that you've made, a short film, is called Black Book. And we have a girl who buys her boyfriend a rare book. Tell me about the inspiration for Black Book.
Just like filmmaking, I've always kind of had like an interest in that kind of paranormal aspect. James Wan, he did The Conjuring films and Insidious, and I think his filmmaking is incredible.
So you were inspired by his work.
Yeah, one of like the biggest elements that I wanted to bring to this movie that I learned through him is kind of letting the audience create the fear for themselves. And what I mean by that is, for example, the movie Signs. That movie scared me a lot when it first came out.
Me too.
And I loved it, but I felt like all the fear got ruined at the very end when they showed the alien, because it kind of put a face to this mysterious figure you were imagining the entire film. So I wanted to keep that element. So our main antagonist, you never fully see what he looks like. And so I want the audience to kind of interpret that for themselves.
So they're really investing more of themselves and their own imagination and their own fears into your narrative.
Exactly.
Which can be a whole lot scarier because only we know what scares us.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was the element that I tried to convey into the film. Whether or not that works, that was the goal.
You cast Illinois State University students in your film. Why do you make that choice?
None of us make a profit off these. We all just do it for fun. We did a talent casting auditions, and we had 15 individuals audition for the two lead roles. And of those, Adam Rabora and Anastasia Ferguson were, in our opinions, the best fit for those characters. It's like you said, they both go here and they're both theater majors, and there's a lot of time invested into these and a lot of passion, and it's important to make sure that the individuals that you work with also share that passion, because if we're not making money, it's literally just based on wanting to tell a good story, and you can only do that if everybody's invested the same. I feel like Adam and Anastasia both share that passion. They helped Vigilant Studios make this film. I hope that it's able to help them, you know, for their future endeavors with acting as well.
You are helping their careers get a start. They can get a leg up. They've got something for their audition reel.
Yeah, I hope so. Something to show. I directed this thing, but I couldn't have made this thing without everybody who was involved with it. And so it's really a collaborative effort to make this thing. And so I love that aspect too, of just putting all these people together and letting each person kind of put their talents out there and throw their ideas out there and bring up things that you never would have thought of. Very fortunate for my cast and crew for this one.
Well, how will something like Black Book help you and your career? Are you looking to put this on the film festival circuit?
We are planning to submit this to several film festivals. I don't know how many yet. Each one has an entry fee, and my production partner, Ricky, and myself, you know, we fund all the expenses for what we do. You know, obviously, we're both newly out of college, and we don't have, you know, thousands of dollars to dump into making these films, so we just kind of have to do the best with what we got. We're trying to be strategic about which ones we submit to. Our end game is that we would like to eventually make full feature films. And we've actually spent probably the past 9 months or so writing the script for our first one. And it's a dramedy. But at the same time, we also have ideas for two other short films. And we would like to do those prior to that. I think that Black Book, every aspect actually, from the way it was shot, to the lighting, to the acting, to the writing, is a huge leg up from Beyond Normal. And so I think if we continue trying to just make each film better than the last, after we have four or five shorts ready to go, we'll have something to show to maybe get like a Kickstarter or GoFundMe and have some sort of, even if it's just a small budget, to make a full feature.
John Sayles does crowdfunding.
Oh, really?
With some of his works as well. So you're basically following in that indie film tradition with looking at perhaps doing some crowdfunding for your upcoming projects.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, I think the aspects of the independent genre of films, I think there's a lot more area for creativity than working in Hollywood. Yeah, that would be great. But at the same time, I feel like you get into that blockbuster mindset where you're just trying to make money. And right now, our focus isn't making money. It's just trying to tell a good story. I like that independent, you know, feel for films. And I feel like the ones that I connect with the most are films that come out of Sundance that otherwise people wouldn't see if it wasn't in a festival like that.
So you shot here around Bloomington Normal. Was the town agreeable to you making a film? I mean, you didn't have any trouble getting permits or you know, have to deal with any problems like that? I mean, one of your locales in Black Book is Babbitt's Books in Uptown Normal.
Yeah, for both our first film and this one, we've just been very fortunate with the help of the community. We don't have basically any budget, really. It's very tiny, if anything, and we have to use our resources. And so for our first film, Tyler Holloway owns Fat Jack's, and he agreed to let us film there. And then one of my friends was a server over at Medici, and one of his bosses was a banquet manager. And he agreed to let us film part of that film there. In this case, we kind of just walked into Babbitt's one day and talked to one of the guys named Seth, and he's a really nice guy, and explained kind of what we wanted to do, and they were fully supportive of letting us come in there. We were only going to be there for one morning for a couple hours. That one morning turned into 4 or 5 hours, and then we also had to come back and do reshoots, and they were completely accommodating, which was great.
Can I help you find something?
I was wondering if you had anything on medieval legends. It's my fiancé's birthday today, and I've been so busy, I really haven't had the chance to get him anything.
We have a small collection in the back.
Great.
This book was donated to us 12 years ago.
It looks like some of his old coursework. Do you know anything about it?
I contacted several ministries and none of them would discuss it.
Another location we used was Mavidia Technology Group. My mom's an office manager there, and they're not operating on the weekends, but their space is this brand new, very tech-based company. It served a great, you know, setting for an office setting.
Zach, can making short films really advance your career? Is there a storied history of that in the film industry?
I would like to eventually make films as a career. It's a very tiresome process, and so I work full-time, and so I have my day job, and
you work at State Farm in video production?
Yeah, and our audio engineer, all of us kind of wear multiple hats with our crew, and so his name's Steven Williams, and he's a very talented individual. He wrote all the music with two of his buddies for the film, did all the sound design, audio post-production, was even the field mic leader. So he's invested probably close to 100 hours on this thing, and he also works with me at State Farm doing audio work. So I mean,
so it really has to be something you love doing.
Yeah,
you know, this is not for money. This is for the joy of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep your spirits up, though?
I just keep thinking about the final outcome. I've seen this thing from the beginning, when it was just an idea in our heads, all the way until now when we're about to put it out to the theater. And so there have been moments, and even with Beyond Normal, where I did think that, you know what, maybe this thing isn't going to get made, or we'd be, you know, halfway through production and I would feel like I'm not as happy with this as I could be, or this is going to be too much work. I don't know if we can push this out. And especially these past few weeks has been really rough, knowing that, okay, the 29th of this month, this thing is coming out, and we're still tweaking color and doing final mixes on the audio. So it's just down to the wire kind of vibe. But, you know, it is really stressful, but it's also rewarding to think about that night and getting that audience reaction, you know, and seeing what people think of it.
That's Zach Fairley from Vigilant Studios. His new short film, Black Book, is showing at the Normal Theater tomorrow night at 5:30 p.m., also on May the 3rd. Admission is free. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can view Zach Fairley's first short film, Beyond Normal, at the Vigilant Studios website. You're listening to Insidious from the film Insidious, composed by Joseph Bishara.
Imagine in an instant becoming the focus of worldwide ridicule and shame.
You feel very alone, very isolated. It's like a heavy blanket, a heavy, suffocating blanket.
How Monica Lewinsky learned to endure and to become resilient, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a moment, Hip Pocket. Perhaps one of the most challenging jobs is to work as a hospice chaplain, a companion who's to those who are facing the final chapter of life. Hospice chaplain Carrie Egan has written about her experiences in a new book called On Living. GLT's Judy Valente sat down to talk about the wisdom Egan says she finds in the stories her patients tell her about their lives. Egan says people go into hospice with a certain amount of regret.
You know, I don't think anybody can live a full life without having some regrets. And I feel like sometimes as a culture, we hold up regret as a terrible thing. You know, you hear people say, you hear like slogans on T-shirts, live your life with no regret. I guess it's an interesting goal, but it's not reasonable, right? It's not something I've ever seen in all the people I've talked to as a hospice chaplain. You know, hundreds of people, thousands of people, not a single person had no regrets. So this idea that you could live a life with no regrets, I think it sometimes sets people up to almost paralyze them. That just seems especially sad to me because then you're sort of stuck. There's as many people, as different as every person is, when they're living, that's how different they are when they're dying, and there can be a million different regrets.
How do you tell people to deal with that, particularly if they know that their time on this earth is very short?
What happens with regret is that it can be a way to see what your real hope is. Regret is what hones hope. Regret is what helps you see, oh, this is what I wished had happened. And then you can, if you can really look at your regrets, if you can hold them up sort of in the daylight, you're given this chance to see, oh, what are my hopes? So while I still have whatever time I have left on life, whether you're in hospice and that's a month, or, you're 35 years old and it's hopefully another 60 years, you can redefine that hope. And then you can move forward trying to make that hope come true.
Some of the stories that you relate in your book, they have to do with shame or grief or trauma. Why are those the stories people are telling at the end of their lives?
If people want to talk about the difficult things that happened in their lives, it usually has to do with loss or shame. And I think it's because those are two of the experiences that really pull your sense of identity out from under you. You know, you think you are one person. You think that the world works in a certain way. And then you have these experiences that just pull that sense of meaning and identity out from under you. And it's really frightening. I mean, that's the definition of a spiritual crisis right there. You know, who you are, who God is, who your family is, what love is, all of those things, those spiritual questions. Sometimes you want a chaplain with you to talk through it. And the patient is the one who does that work. But the chaplain is there. The chaplain's been there before. She sees that it can be done. And she can ask some good questions to help you on that path. And I always want to tell people, when you have a visit with a chaplain, it's not always these really deep, heavy stories. You know, a lot of times those visits are just really kind of fun, pleasant visits where maybe you sing songs or you tell funny stories. It's not always these really, really deep, painful stories.
You point out that a lot of people are holding on to secrets throughout their lives. And they come to this point when they're in hospice where these secrets bubble up to the surface, if you will, and they have to be dealt with.
The story that really, I think, talks about the secrets most head-on was a very beloved patient of mine who, her eldest son, had a different father than the rest of her children and a different father than her husband. And she had never told her eldest son who his biological father was. And this was such a heavy, shameful secret in her life that she felt so ashamed of. Yet at the same time, her name was, I call her Gloria in the book. The problem with her secret, and with a lot of secrets, is that she was keeping this secret because she thought she was going to protect her son from the shame. But what it meant is that she couldn't tell her son that in her view of her life, looking back over her life, she really believed that the greatest act she had ever done, the thing that took the most strength, that shaped her life, the thing she was most proud of, was the fact that after he was born, she was going to give him up for adoption. Because that's what people did at the time. You know, this was a long time ago. And she came home from the unwed mother's home, and she said, I woke up in the morning, and I couldn't breathe. And I realized I had made the biggest mistake of my life, and that I had to fix this mistake. And she said, and I called the home, and I said, what do I need to do to get my son back? And they said, well, you would have to pay the adoption fee, which basically would consist of all of the expenses for the 6 months that you lived here at this unwed mother's home, you know, all of your food, all of your lodging, all of your doctor's visits, the cost of the delivery, the medical care for the baby, when you'd have to pay for all of that. And if you could pay that, then you could have your baby back. You'd have to basically, as she put the word, she said, I'd have to buy him back.
And she does.
And she does.
She somehow scrapes the money together.
She does. And she tells this really amazing story about how she sold everything she owned. And the one detail that always jumped out at me is she said, I even sold my curlers, her hair curlers. She sold all of her clothes except one pair of stockings and one dress to get that baby back. She said, it was the greatest thing I've done in my whole life. I got my baby back. And so at the end of her life, she really wanted him to know how much she loved him.
Interestingly enough, she asks you to tell the son. How did you as a chaplain decide what to do? What actually happened then?
So there are a couple times in my career as a chaplain where I was literally speechless, like where I literally had no idea what to do, almost like I froze. That for a second, I didn't know what to say. I really didn't. I just kind of sat there. I was just kind of frozen for a few seconds. I mean, I knew immediately that that was not something I should do. I said, oh, Gloria, I think you should tell him yourself. I think that's really big news, and that needs to come from you and not me. And she almost panicked. She said, I can't do it. I cannot do that. And then maybe a couple weeks later, she said, well, maybe I could tell him the story, and you could sit next to me. And that was a huge step. That was a huge step. And I said, yeah, that might could work. That sounds like a good plan. And then a couple weeks later, she just said out of the blue, I told my son when he was here this weekend. She didn't tell me she was going to do it. She just did it. And I said, how did it go? And she started to laugh and cry at the same time, which it went very well. She was happy with how it went.
I'm Judy Valente. You're listening to Sound Ideas. We're talking with Carrie Egan, who is the author of On Living, a book about her experiences as a hospice chaplain. What about the people who don't accept that they are going to die soon, even though they're in hospice?
As the chaplain, you know, it's not my job to get people to accept their mortality, right? It's my job as a hospice chaplain to meet you where you are, whatever your spiritual struggle is. And, you know, and some people don't have many spiritual struggles at the end of their life. But it's to meet you where you are and what your struggle is and help you through it in the way that works for you. Sometimes people get really alarmed when I say things like that, and they say, don't you feel like you need to sort of tell them about religion, or you need to, sometimes people will use, especially in South Carolina, is they're okay with God, you know, they're right with God. I always say, no, that is not my job, because I have a lot of faith in God. I have an enormous amount of faith that God is going to make people right with God, that I am not the one who's going to save people. I'm not the one who's going to make answer people's spiritual questions. The patient and the Holy Spirit are going to do that together. And I've seen it happen over and over and over again. I'm just the witness.
Is there a difference between people who come into hospice who have a strong faith and people who come into hospice with no faith, feeling that this life is it?
You know, I've had patients who have no faith, no belief in an afterlife, who are enormously at peace, who will say, you know what, my body is going to decay and I will cease to exist, and I did all the good I could while I was here. And I've had people with enormous, strong faith who are in a panic. What I do think faith does, we all sort of have these spiritual toolboxes, you know, that when we face these spiritual crises, when we have to answer these big questions, we're not without tools to face this. And our religious faith, our beliefs are can be an enormously helpful tool in making meaning. But they're not the only tool. And the more I work as a chaplain, the more I've come to realize that things like literature, you know, the books that people have read can be enormously helpful. The music that they listen to, their family and friends, their experiences, their work, the work they did in their lives. All of these can be tools that you use to help you answer these big questions.
That was Carrie Egan of Columbia, South Carolina, talking with GLT's Judy Valente. Egan's new book about her experiences as a hospice chaplain is called On Living. Egan says she hopes readers learn how they can create meaning in their own lives from learning about the way other people have lived. Hear another part of the life of a hospice chaplain, actually a couple parts, at the Community Cancer Center during Sound Ideas on Monday. It's been a month of reunion shows of longtime Central Illinois favorite bands. The Something Brothers, Mojo Stew, and the Mechanics all got together for a benefit show at the Castle Theater in early April. This Saturday night, the R&B funk longtime favorite Hip Pocket will reunite with friends old and new. Band leader and founder Mark Boone joined John Norton in the GLT studio to talk about the band's history and why he wanted to do one more show.
We had planned a long time ago to be able to do this. Mike, last year we were starting to do it, but then with the mix of people and everything else getting together, it just didn't seem to want to come to fruition. But the real reason, I think, for me, other than a couple people coming up and saying, when are you guys going to get back together or do something? And I never even thought about it. But losing three friends last year who had recently retired, very good friends, and died, cancer. I think at some point along the line we get into a stage of life where we sit there and start taking count of stuff. And I said to myself, I'm going to miss these people a tremendous amount. And I would miss all of those people that I had a chance to play with over 25 years with Hip Pocket the same. And I think at that point I said, I want to get the guys together again at least one more time, make some music, so we have one last memory to be able to share.
Were these three guys part of the band?
One was. One had been of my current band that I'm in right now. And then others were just very good friends. And out of the five people that were very close to me last year, those struck home the most because they were so close in age to me. And of all of my bandmates, other than a couple of the young kids that have come along over the years. But, you know, we're all getting to that age where, you know, you don't think of 60, 61, 62 people dying. I mean, I'm sure it's happened over the millions of years, but you just don't think of it. And it started hitting home really hard.
You still feel 25 years old?
At times?
Yeah.
And I think having kids now, having an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old, gives you a sense of youth in some ways, but it also gives you a strong sense of the finality of things too, you know, because I'm not 18, I'm not 25, I'm not even 40 anymore. And this does not come easy. That energy to find, to play, does not come as easy as it once did.
Back in the day, in its heyday, how many members were part of Hip Pocket? I mean, like on stage at one time as opposed to people right. filtering in and out of the band.
Probably the most we had on stage, other than the last shuffle, which was our last show that we did five years ago, whatever. It was nine. Nine was a real good number for us.
Okay.
With horns and harps and everything else going on. But coming up, it's going to be a little larger.
Oh, well, how many?
16.
Because it's old friends and new.
Friends and new. There'll be 16 of us. Nine-piece horn section. Which during rehearsals made the rhythm section stop on more than one occasion just to go, wow. It's kind of an amazing thing. But, nine for the most part, maybe 10 every now and then. And that was the thing. We were in such flux. There were new people kind of coming in and out, particularly those first 4 years, man. It was hard to – I guess I'm a hard person to work for.
Let me get to that in just a bit. What are some of the songs, or maybe can you mention a specific song or two that was really emblematic of Hip Pocket in its
all
time?
The Delbert McClinton stuff, B-Movie Boxcar Blues, Standing on Shaky Ground, Someday Baby, those were real hallmarks for us. I mean, when we first started out, and we were kind of all over the road, but then we kind of started honing in because we saw the popularity that Delbert had, and he had some same kind of thing, and I'd always liked Delbert's music at any rate, and finally started thinking that his voice or his sound was a little bit closer to where my natural singing voice was.
Oh, okay.
And is. So it just started kind of falling into place. And then people enjoyed dancing to it. Those of us men who don't usually dance very often could get out on the floor and move their feet around a little bit and do something with it. Once we found the key to the sound, things just really took off.
What was that key?
Instead of trying to sing like B.B. King or to sing like Big Twist and Larry Nolan and some people like that, it was singing in my own voice. I found myself listening to tapes. I'm going, that doesn't sound like me. Who am I trying to be here? And I thought, well, no, I need to find my own voice. When I found my own voice, I think that also helped the band in knowing, well, Mark's not trying to be B.B. King. He's not trying to be Bobby Bland. He's just being him. And then they all became themselves, just putting in what their natural gifts into the picture. And then all of a sudden, just things started to gel. People stuck around in the band longer. We had good runs with solid nucleus of people. But I think that was the biggest thing, me not trying to be somebody I wasn't.
Lady Luck and four-leaf clover, won't ease the pain I feel all over. My life is one special occasion, living it up in this situation. Just standing on shaky ground.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. The other voice you're hearing is Mark Boone, who is spearheading a Hip Pocket reunion this weekend at the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington. When you mentioned there were nine guys basically in there, that was your sweet spot for a number on stage at a time. That's like herding cats as a band leader to try to get all that on the same page, practice time and at gigs. How difficult was that?
Too many relationships gone down the drain. It was hard, and I don't think I really even realized what a toll it took on me, because I just heaped that on me. I wanted to make sure that I hired people to come in and do their part. Bass player, just come in and play bass. You don't have to book gigs. You don't have to get rehearsal time. I'll do that. And I think now, at least that's my lovely wife, CJ, has said, I can't in some ways wait until this is over with, because you're a different person. And I don't know what you would have been like to live with during those times, because it was hard when you got nine schedules to be able to work around.
Yeah,
summertime would come around. Everybody wants to take vacations. Well, that's time to make money. That's fair time. That's Sugar Creek. That's all the other festivals and things that were going on, and you have to keep track of things. And then after a while, I just started saying, look, if you can't make it to the gig, it's scheduled. You schedule something after that. You got to find somebody to either fill your hole and do it as well as you do, or you're going to have to make the gig because that's what you signed up for. I was a taskmaster, and it's cost friendships, it's cost an awful lot, but I think in the end, it kept everybody going, hey, all I have to do is just come and do my part, Mark's got the rest.
So you referenced your wife said, yeah, you should be glad when this is over because you're a different person because of the build-up to the show.
Just the stress of trying. Yeah. I mean, we were trying to be able to get this many people together and get those rehearsals done, get the space, all of those kinds of things, just is really taking its toll.
Well, what are you hearing from your former fans of Hip Pocket? They must be pretty geeked about their show.
Well, yeah, they're pretty pumped.
And the guys that are playing with you?
They're pretty pumped about it, yeah. When we're sitting in during the rehearsals that we've had, it's cool because all these old stories, these things, and a lot of stuff that I completely forgot about, but just the gigs that we went through and stuff, and just a lot of laughter and just wonderful friendships.
Well, reunions are about memories,
absolutely,
a lot of it. What are some of the stories, some of the memories that are popping up with you and the guys?
The ones that I can tell even on public radio. we all just had such a great time opening for BB over at the Madison. That was just an absolute cherry moment, I think, for everybody. We were all kind of shuffling around a few of those kinds of things, and that was one of those shows that kind of came up. The trips to D.C. For the inaugural balls were always interesting in trying to get the logistics and everything else together. But once we got there, there were just so many funny little things that happened in restaurants and stuff like that that we all kind of remember, and those who drove waitresses crazy and that sort of thing. The first CD release party that we did at the old Paragon Ballroom was just so cool because we expected maybe 150, 200 people would come to this thing. And there we are, before we even opened up the doors, there's line out the door, wrapping around the building. They start coming in, and then we realize we don't have enough tables set up, we don't have enough chairs. So dads and brothers and moms and family were all scrambling, getting more tables out. And they just kept coming until they were standing. And we were in awe of that. That was just something really kind of special for us.
Well, with the reunion of the Mechanics, Mojo Stew, and the Something Brothers just a few weeks ago, It looks like the Something Brothers may continue this, at least on a short. It's not going to be a Hip Pocket continuation, it sounds like.
I don't think so. I mean, I think 5-6 years ago when I was talking about the last shuffle that we did on the last show, I was kind of, you know, well, what do you think? And I said, you never say never.
I remember you telling me that.
Yeah.
Yep.
You try not to say never about things. But I think we're all just getting to that point where I think putting our energies into one last show, having these young players with us that are coming in and helping to support and bolster up the horn section and stuff. One of the other real cool things about it, if I could take a left-hand turn, Tim Durham was my harmonica player for, I think, almost 12
really?
Years.
Really? I didn't know that.
And Timmy and his son, Andrew, I can remember pictures when we played one of the first blues festivals in Peoria where it was in a parking lot, basically, the stage was, and there were parking blocks set up everywhere, and people had their chairs out there. It was not the organized, beautiful place that you have now to be able to see it down on the riverfront in Peoria. But anyway, we're sitting here, and Andrew's in his son is has his little plastic harmonica and is in the little chair out in front, and just kind of seeing that. Well, now Andrew's coming back and he's playing harp with Tim. He's going to be on stage with Tim. He also is a mean tenor player, so he's going to be joining the horn section as well. One of the sparks for me and one of the cool things about the show is going to be able to see Tim on stage with his son, Andrew, for maybe the only time, at least with this band. So,
well, how cool is that? Mark Boone,
cool.
Hip Pocket reunion this weekend. Thank you for coming in and talking about
thanks.
This.
Oh, thanks. It's been my pleasure.
A lot of people are geeked about this one.
It's going to be fun. And if you want to see us, I think probably now would be the better time to do it. Like I say, never want to say never, but let's do this. Let's have some fun and make a great memory to go on.
Thanks to R.C. McBride and Willis Kern, Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and John Norton for today's show. This is WGLT Normal.